This week on Making Contact,
people who are treated like animals, people who are tortured, never get over it.
This is only a disease. I didn't ask for it. So I decided I will just tell the world.
Women are gaining influence as leaders throughout the world, fighting for peace, justice, the environment, and civil society. In this program, we profile two activists facing the most difficult health and human rights issues of our time. Mary Pfeiffer is a psychologist and popular author who has taken on the American Psychological Association for cooperating with the U.S. government on the use of torture. And Prudence Mabele is a prominent South African activist in the battle to stop the spread of HIV/AIDS. I'm Sandina Robbins, your host this week on Making Contact. This program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising radio series. When the American Psychological Association held its 2007 convention in San Francisco, the organization faced a critical issue. Should its membership continue to work with the U.S. government in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and secret CIA black sites worldwide, designing and supervising so-called enhanced interrogations that human rights groups define as torture? Psychologist Mary Pfeiffer, author of the bestseller Reviving Ophelia and other books, was watching the APA debate on this controversial issue very closely.
At the American Psychological Convention in San Francisco, 150 psychologists who are members of the APA Council, and by the way, it's a very small proportion of psychologists. There's 150,000 members of the organization. So it's essentially a thousandth of the membership. A very small group of psychologists who are on the council voted on what was called Substitute Motion 3. The substitute refers to the fact that this particular motion was passed in lieu of a moratorium banning psychologists from participating in places like Guantanamo and the CIA black sites that are outside the Geneva Conventions. Many of the people that voted had direct ties to the military, including financial ties to the military. Most of the membership was probably not very aware of the significance of this issue. One of the reasons it's so significant and its impact goes far beyond the ethics of my own particular field is that the only people now who are working with the CIA in these places that do not come under Geneva Conventions are psychologists. So when President Bush is asked, what's the difference between, say, some dictator torturing people in a prison halfway around the world and what the American government's doing, his response can be, all of our interrogations are done under medical supervision. Well, the only medical supervisors are psychologists. The American Medical Association will not permit its members to be there. The American Psychiatric Association will not permit its members to participate in these enhanced interrogations. Neither will the American Nursing Association. So if psychologists had voted against our members' participation and banned psychologists working in these sites, these sites could not exist. Guantanamo would have had to been shut down. We would have had to shut down these black sites because there would have been no person there who could give them any legitimacy. Being a psychologist, being a therapist, I've worked with trauma victims my whole life. I have a very good sense for the effect of trauma on human beings. And since the late 80s, I've done a great deal of work with torture victims, and I've had the training at Harvard and various other places. I've been up to the Center for Victims of Torture in Minneapolis and so on. And I've talked to many people who are victims of torture. I've written a book called In the Middle of Everywhere about the refugees in our community, many of whom have been tortured and whom I interviewed. But I know two things about torture for sure. One of them is that many people who are tortured are absolutely innocent of anything. They just happen to be unfortunate enough to be in the wrong demographic group or in the wrong place at the wrong time. And the second thing I know is that people who are treated like animals, people who are tortured, never get over it. You're profoundly changed at the soul level by the kind of experiences that the U.S. government and some psychologists are inflicting on people. So this particular motion was passed in lieu of a moratorium banning psychologists from participating in places like Guantanamo and the CIA black sites that are outside the Geneva Conventions. And when I heard about this, I was really disappointed. And I wanted to say something to psychologists. I wanted to do something about this. And I was very fortunate. The year before, I'd been honored by a presidential citation from Dr. Gerald Kucher, then president of the American Psychology Association. And so I decided I would very publicly give back that award. And I did. And then I made public my letter sending back this award. I did some interviews on radio and with newspapers and magazines and so on. And it was out in the blogosphere for a while. And I think it did, at least within our organization, provoke a great deal of action that may inspire another vote at APA and perhaps a different outcome. What could still happen is if psychologists say they will no longer work in these sites, they will be shut down. And that would be a very good step in terms of our country once again being a civilized country and our country once again having the respect of other countries.
Since Mary Pfeiffer went public with her protest, other psychologists have come out against the APA's position and even resigned over its decision allowing the U.S. government to use psychologists as a way to legitimize the practice of torture. They also criticized the APA leadership for discouraging dissent on the issue. Psychology departments at several colleges have passed resolutions calling on the APA to change its policy on this highly controversial issue. Mary Pfeiffer is glad to see her fellow psychologists taking these positive steps, but she cautions that our use of torture is a symptom of a broad, deep sickness in the United States, which we as a society need to address.
We live in a really dreadfully pornographic culture, which is a very different thing from an erotic culture. I would suspect that the link between pornography and Abu Ghraib is something like this, that in order to hurt other human beings, you must be able to imagine them not as people like you, not as living beings who are in your circle of caring, but as objects that basically have no dignity, no innate worth, and no feelings worth worrying about. And so I think violence and pornography are inextricably linked. I did a tape that's being used by the Department of Defense on helping the families of soldiers while they're in Iraq. And I interviewed some soldiers and their families, all male soldiers it happened to be. And they talked about how one of the things they had really hated about serving there was there's pornography everywhere, that all the soldiers, or many of them, are using pornography, and that there's pornographic films shown regularly and so on. And one way to understand this, I think, is that watching pornography is essentially a brutalizing experience. And you need to be a brutal person to work at Abu Ghraib. You need to be a coarse person who doesn't see everyone he or she meets as a fellow member of the human race. Now, America in particular has a very bad situation right now in terms of what I call weaponized language. And that is the kind of language that groups people into us-them categories and that makes certain people less than human. For example, terrorist is probably the ultimate word. Once someone's called a terrorist, they are definitely less than human. Illegal alien. There could hardly be a phrase better designed to put someone outside another person's moral imagination than calling them an illegal alien. I really think one of the greatest sicknesses in America right now is just a lack of moral imagination, an inability to understand that at heart we're all the same and that all people are mixes of good and evil and that all of us are extraordinarily complicated and even on a more basic level, that it's impossible to solve human problems without understanding humans, that you cannot just shout slogans and send bombs at people and make the world a better place.
Every time you love just a little, take one step closer, solving the riddle. It echoes all over the world. Every time you open to kindness, make one connection used to divide us.
When I was a girl, I was very lucky. I was raised by, my mother was a doctor. And she took her medical ethics very, very seriously. And I remember her quoting her Hippocratic Oath. For example, one thing she often said was that doctors are not allowed to do harm to anyone for someone else's interest. And another point she made was her job was to always pay attention to the welfare of her patient as her highest priority. Now, my mother practiced in small rural Nebraska towns, and my father had been a medic in World War II in the Philippines and the South Pacific. A lot of times we'd be driving down some little road in Nebraska, and we'd see a farm accident, or one time we saw a little plane crash, a crop duster crash. And many times we came across car accidents. And my folks would tell us children to stay in the car, and my mother would grab her little doctor bag, and she and my dad would run for a burning plane or a wrecked car or whatever, and they would take care of the people. And they didn't ask, are there Republicans or Democrats in this car? Or have the people in this car ever been arrested? Or are they legally in our country, or do they pay their taxes? They just took care of those people. And my feeling is psychology is like medicine in that way, that our job as psychologists is to work for the betterment of the human race and to take care of anyone who comes within our environment. Anyone who we are with is under our protection as psychologists. Right now, psychologists are on the wrong side of history, and the United States government is on the wrong side of world ethics and politics. We are behaving in a way that is against the beliefs of the Red Cross, the Geneva Conventions, the Declaration of Human Rights, and eventually we will be held accountable.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Today's program is a special collaboration with the Women Rising Radio Series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit us on the web or listen to our podcast at radioproject.org. Statistics on the global AIDS crisis are staggering. More than 22 million people have died from AIDS. Over 42 million are living with the disease. Nearly half are women. The United Nations estimates that 14 million children have been orphaned from AIDS, and that in just a few years, the number of orphans could double. Sub-Saharan Africa has been hit the hardest. It was there in 1993 that a young South African university student named Prudence Mabele discovered she was HIV positive.
It devastated me to just learn that. I had had dreams like, I want to qualify as an analytical chemistry professional one day. I have had a boyfriend at the institution where I was studying, and he just graduated as a medical student. This was my first boyfriend. I began feeling a bit sick. I just used to have headaches, and the headaches were migraine. Then from there, it was just me getting results and my entire life just changing within a second, yeah? That's how things were. I knew it was a white gay man disease in the 90s, and I knew also if I was a sex worker, it could have even been a way of explaining how it happened, because that's what it was in the old days, nothing in between. So I am going to deal with this, but I cannot just be quiet. I have to talk to someone. And each and every time I spoke to someone, I got rejected. The medical profession, they can't deal with me. The outside world can't deal with me. The church can't deal with me. The institution where I'm studying, they can't deal with me. Really, who can deal with me except me? Because even the very same boyfriend has just also dumped me. So it was just too much. So I was beginning to be suicidal because the acceptance was just getting thinner every time. I eventually decided, you know what? This is only a disease. I didn't ask for it. So I decided I will just tell the world.
Prudence Mabele became an activist, participating in the establishment of the Treatment Action Campaign, a powerful advocacy group that succeeded in pressuring the South African government to create its first national AIDS plan. Prudence also worked with the National AIDS Convention of South Africa, and she was a founding member of the National Association of People Living with HIV.
So we were trying to organize a conference, which was Global Network of People Living with HIV and AIDS, where I was partly really involved in organizing. Then I had to give my speech in there, not knowing if I was going to disclose. And there were 700 people from around the world who were HIV positive. The Minister of Health was there, the Deputy President was there, and many other agencies. And I spoke and I disclosed my status. And for the first time, I could speak about how it was to be me. And frankly and honestly, and I could not believe it. I even cried. That's how much I was holding up all this time. I got a lot of people acknowledging. They stood up and they clapped and all of that. But that was the moment. I never thought about it, and I didn't even plan it. And as soon as it has happened, it was on CNN, it was on national TV, it was on BBC, it was everywhere. It was like I've just outed myself to the world. Every newspaper had me. Every newspaper has written in the front page. And now I must live my life after that in a country where there's stigma, in the country where there isn't anyone that has ever spoken about it. It was really difficult because then I saw how much I didn't have support. Suddenly those international guests were all gone. Here I was. Everybody recognizes me. They're pointing fingers at the malls everywhere, but people don't know how to behave. They run away. They're not quite sure if they should stand or not. So it was very difficult. I had to just go away for 3 weeks. And then I had to come back and say, okay, what next now? So I decided to channel my anger into being positive, educating other people, helping other people like me. I went to the Red Cross Children's Hospital where I decided I'm going to volunteer. They just had babies who were HIV infected because there were no drugs. There was nothing. So if you were pregnant, you just give it to your baby. So there were many children in that clinic, and those children were infected from their mothers. I knew it. We were in trouble, and this disease is already targeting women, young women, married women. I knew that in 1993. In the old days, women living with HIV were not seen as women who could have rights. They were just victims, you know, sinners, guilty because they bring these kids that are HIV. So that was my major issue. But in addressing the women's rights, I had to look at the human rights, women's rights. I had to look at the reproductive health. I had to also look at the what does it mean to a woman in the grassroots, to a woman in the township, to a woman who doesn't have a job, to a woman who is just being diagnosed, whose self-esteem is as low, to all of that. And that translated us just doing a lot of empowerment work that embraces us, that makes us love ourselves. And in the past, I've seen a lot of women who had to die because they couldn't talk for themselves. At the Positive Women's Network, which is the project that I co-founded in 1996, the first group were 60. And out of the 60, 58 died. Two are surviving from the first group. So it was also about that. And I think I had it in me that I'll be here with or without treatment. I was just driven. I could see myself, even when I'm ill, I would just be there in the hospital bed, but saying, with or without, I'm going to be back. I have to be back. So it was just in my spirit. I even used to visualize and say my spirit would keep me going. It was like a song in my heart or in my brain. So many opportunities were there. I could have died. So many great women who are so strong, who I respected, that I've learned so much, they've died. And that is the truth of the matter with this thing. I've seen kids. I can tell a long story about what has happened, but I still survive. I've seen good gay men who were there, who helped us start a lot of things on the ground, and they're not here with us, but I still survive. I safely stayed committed. It was like a song in my heart.
When apartheid ended in South Africa, Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress were hobbled by the white power elite that still controlled the economy. Mandela's hands were also tied by a World Trade Organization agreement preventing South Africa from producing its own antiviral AIDS drugs. This meant that most South Africans could not afford the expensive medication. And after Mandela left office, the ANC government denied the AIDS crisis, turning its back on the 5.5 million South Africans who needed help. Prudence Mabele intensified the struggle for safe, affordable treatment.
I remember I was ill. I was on the wheelchair, but I went to see the office of the WTO, World Trade Organization, and I spoke to them as a minority, as a woman, black woman from the township, poor because I was ill and I couldn't afford to buy those drugs. We won the case. I was in the media. I was always there doing a lot, talking to the TVs. And then it was just getting worse and worse. Again in the courts. Again, here we are, civil disobedience. Again, we're talking to the world to support us. And then after winning that case, then now it was supposed to be implementation. It also was a push We were pushing so hard to asking them to even provide the smaller drugs. They started with 22,000 people, and we had 5 million who were infected then. So there were long waiting lists, so that also wasn't solving our problems. So we had to get really busy. We co-founded PATAM, Pan-African Treatment Action Movement. When we had conferences such as Africa Conference on AIDS, we had to be there outside chanting, doi-doing, running around while they are talking, you talk, we die, you know, having such slogans. But now, South Africa, Africa, we were together. We wrote a new national strategic plan on HIV and AIDS, 2007 to 2011. And this plan says it will reduce 50% of new cases of HIV, and it would treat 80% of people living with HIV with treatment. And if we do what we have written in that plan, I think would save a lot of life in South Africa. And I think we would help the spread to end.
Recently, the U.S. government created a $15 billion fund to fight the AIDS pandemic in Africa through the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, referred to as PEPFAR. Prudence Mabeli says it is both a blessing and a curse because of the conditions attached to the use of the money.
As much as the PEPFAR is doing good work, the only problem with the fund is it's conditional. He prefers we should talk about abstinence. So it's restricted, and it really has created a huge problem because for countries such as Uganda that have really reduced HIV, they can now turn around and say to people, just abstain only. They have to give people options. They were one of the countries that we can say at least they have used their strategies in making sure everyone wears a condom. So why are we turning that to saying people must abstain when we know it, that people won't abstain? When I feel really inspired is some women have lived their lives back to normal after HIV diagnosis, where they now have decided they want to have families. And they've thought about it, they've thought through it. They can tell you who's going to be the godmother if they were to go. And they've just planned the whole thing, and they're going on. They're taking their rights back, and they're living again. That inspires me. And also, even just to walk and see a clinic is working. The sisters are committed, there's a doctor there. And people are getting ARVs, that makes me so happy.
That's it for this Women's Desk edition of Making Contact. These profiles of international changemakers were co-produced with Lynn Feinerman's Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. You can learn more about the work of these courageous women at radioproject.org. If you'd like to order a CD of this program, our toll-free number is 800-529-5736. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Additional music courtesy of Sibongile Kumalo and Dar Williams. Stephanie Welch is production engineer. Lisa Rudman is the executive director. Tina Rubio, senior producer. Puck Lowe, associate producer. Joaquin Palomino and Elena Botkin-Levy, interns, and volunteers Dan Turner, Ron Rucker, and the Monday Morning Breakfast Crew. And I'm your host, Sandina Robbins.